Kevin Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Growing vegetables is fun, but what do you do when you're sick of all the zucchini? You trade it for peaches. I'll tell you how. Urban farming goes mobile with gardening in the bed of a pickup truck. Get your compass and let's go trekking through LA to find and eat at some of the many ethnic pockets in this giant city. Plus a cold and dripping history of ice cream. But first, a look at the legendary Santa Monica Farmers Market this week to see what's in season.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I ran into Amanda Cushman today at the Farmers Market, and I took one of Amanda's wonderful classes up at Chef Makers about a year ago. Tell us what you're cooking right now for summer.
Right now for summer, I was just mentioning that I have a lot of grilling classes that are really popular. Once you put the word grilling and summer together, it's kind of like a natural combination. Everybody gets involved, especially men, which is great. And there's something about grilling, I guess it's because it's very simple. The food tastes really good. It's pretty much no maintenance. You don't have to wash any dishes.
And there's fire involved.
And there's fire
involved. It's always fun, yeah.
Guys like that.
Tell us about marinating the vegetables first. How do you prep them for the grill? Because you don't want them to dry out and you don't want them to be too greasy. So what do you do?
I put a little bit of olive oil. Eggplant, of course, is like a sponge. So you have to be careful that you don't put it on too far ahead, because what happens, it just kind of absorbs it. And you don't have to add more, because what happens is as you start cooking it, it will release some of its juices. Like all vegetables, it's mostly water. So what happens is you don't really want to, even though it looks like it's kind of dried out, you just leave it. And as it cooks, it'll start doing its thing and it won't stick to the pan and it won't need any more oil. So I just do about maybe for like one eggplant, probably about 3 tablespoons of olive oil. Slice the eggplant, drizzle the olive oil. I usually put fresh herbs, rosemary and thyme, garlic. Let it sit in there for maybe half an hour and then just start putting the vegetables on the grill.
Okay, you want to marinate all the vegetables first or the eggplant just the longest?
I think all. It just gives more flavor because with a grilling technique, there's no sauce and there's really no other flavor except whatever you marinated the food in. So
right, and you don't really put anything on the grill itself.
No, nothing on the grill.
So everything is on the vegetables, then you put it on the grill.
Right.
And if you're doing the zucchini, say, do you do it long ways? Like in slabs? You
long
want to get the
ways.
Long? How about
yes.
the eggplant? Same thing?
Same thing.
Yeah?
So much easier to turn.
Yeah.
Those little rounds are really irritating. They kind of fall apart. They end up cooking too quickly.
Or fall in the cracks.
Or fall
in the outside,
cracks.
Yeah.
And I do asparagus. Right now is great. Asparagus is great. Artichokes, red and yellow peppers.
How would you do? Do you parboil the artichokes first?
I do.
You do.
And you want to get the smaller artichokes because the bigger ones take a while to grill. So if you're going to do the big ones, which is really what we have right now, the globe ones, you need to cook them pretty much all the way through. Cut them in half. It's labor intensive. Mm-hmm. Take the choke out, then brush that flat side down with olive oil, and then grill that. So the grilling's really just for flavor at that point.
So good. Okay, so stock up.
Stock up.
Don't
and
be afraid.
Fruit as well.
Oh.
People forget you can grill fruit, and it's great for grilling.
How do you do that?
I do a lot of tropical fruits for that. Pineapple, mango, even peaches, nectarines, plums.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You just cut them in half, take out the little pit. And apricots, this apricot season. Cut them in half, brush them with a little melted butter. I just
put
them flat side down on the grill.
Mm-hmm.
And then I often just leave them plain and serve them with ice cream. Or you can have, I sometimes make like a little rum sauce, which is really yummy.
Well, how do you make that?
It's really yummy. So you take
you
take about 4 tablespoons of butter. And you add about 4 to 5 tablespoons of light brown sugar, and you cook that in a skillet until the sugar's melted. You add a little cinnamon. You take some rum, and you flambé it. Flambéing basically means you heat up the rum in a separate pan. You light it, which gives basically a beautiful effect. If you don't like doing that, you don't have to. But basically what we're doing is burning off all the raw alcohol. You pour that into the brown sugar mixture, and you just shake the pan around until the flame goes out. And then you have a really yummy kind of sugar rum sauce, and you pour that over the fruit.
Oh, my goodness.
That's great.
That sounds so good. It's easy,
and
too.
And easy.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, great. Many, many good ways to enjoy this fruit.
Exactly.
And vegetables. Oh, so great. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Amanda Cushman, and she's obviously an inspired local chef, and she's getting a lot of goodies at the farmer's market and helping us learn how to make the most of the summer. We're talking now with Eric Stenberg, and he's the new face over here at Fairview Gardens Farm at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. And you've got beautiful greens and veggies. We were just talking about grilling, and I couldn't help but notice those beautiful mustard greens you have. And you said you had a great way to grill those. How do you do that?
greens are kind of moving their way out, but we, due to our overcast marine layer weather up in Goleta, we're able to keep growing them into midsummer. So right now we have dandelions and mustards as well, which are really great. Keeping them safe on the grill is the key. Your grill is really strong and powerful, and so we want to protect those tender greens. And so just encasing them in some aluminum foil, creating a basket by crimping down the edges, and then from there you just put in whatever you want to eat with your greens. Your mustard greens and your dandelion greens are a bit on the bitter side, so we suggest a little bit of lemon juice to help kind of balance out the bitterness. Even a little balsamic vinegar, a lot of fresh garlic, a lot of fresh herbs, and then you just kind of put it all in the aluminum foil and stick it on the side of your grill.
And what kind of herbs would you throw in there?
Basil's always a good one. Also, we carry savory here at the Fairview, which is a cross between thyme and rosemary. It's got a nice softer flavor, but it can still handle the intense heat of a roasted herb.
Now, when you're roasting these things on the grill, the one thing I never know is how do you know when it's done?
Don't be afraid to give it a shake, open it up, close it back up. You know, you're looking for a wilted green with the mustards, with the dandelion. It's still a fairly soft. You can go ahead and do the same procedure with kales. And kale is going to be a little bit of a woodier, and it's going to take a little bit longer to cook off. And so then it's just trial and error. Then it's, you know, don't be afraid to overcook it once in a while.
Thanks so much, Eric.
All right.
That was Eric Stenberg, and he is the apprentice over there at Fairview Gardens up in Goleta, which is near Santa Barbara. And he's down at the market, and he's sharing recipes with not only us, but with the customers right here. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Every week, Laura Avery writes a post for our blog of What's Fresh. Find it and what she talked about today at kcrw.com/goodfood. You'll find videos there, too, of produce and of people from the farmer's market. You can watch it on the Good Food Video iPhone and iPod Touch app, or you can see it on our site. Also, Good Food is having a happy hour. Meet me on July 16th at Copa de Oro in Santa Monica. Owner Vincenzo Marianella will make us our very own cocktail from fresh farmers market ingredients. You have to buy your own drinks, but we can hang out together. The bar's on Broadway near the 3rd Street Promenade. Details are online at kcrw.com/goodfood. I hope to see you there. Gardening at home is really taking off. It's a lot of fun to pick ripe tomatoes or zucchini, but what happens when you absolutely can't stand to eat another tomato and you've got tons left to harvest? A new website hopes to help you solve that problem. Just trade your abundance for someone else's and everybody's happy. Rob Anderson is one of the founders of VeggieTrader.com. It's like Craigslist for produce.
You find yourself in that unfortunate situation, or fortunate as it may be actually, where you have too much of something, say tomatoes, and let's say you wanted some apples or something like that, you could go online and basically let people know in your zip code, in your area, that you have too many tomatoes and you're looking for apples. And hopefully other people on the site would be with extra apples, might want your tomatoes, and you guys would get together and make a trade.
Unbelievable idea. How did it start?
It started with us noticing in our neighborhood how much stuff just goes to waste. Unfortunately, you know, you walk around and you'll see an orange tree or an apple tree or a plum tree, and the fruit has gone unpicked and is literally, you know, fallen to the ground and is rotting on the sidewalk. And we think that's a real disconnect, especially given the high price of groceries these days.
And how many people have signed up?
So far, we've had over 5,000 people join the site, which we think is great.
Can you tell what zip codes people are trading in?
So far, we've noticed there seems to be the most activity. It's picking up all across the country at this point, but the most activity has definitely been in Southern California area, which isn't terribly surprising since they have, you know, citrus and their growing season starts a little early.
Wow. Now, is it purely barter, or does any money change hands?
We set it up so that you could trade or sell or whatever you want to do, and it really depends on sort of what the what is required in your area. Some places in the country require a permit, and some places will just let you sell stuff without a permit. Some places will let you trade stuff but not sell stuff without a permit. Other places you can get a permit fairly easily. So it really depends on where you are, what you can do on the site. But we allow people to trade or sell their excess.
Do you worry that brokers and wholesalers might infiltrate VeggieTrader?
We set it up for homegrown produce, and so far I haven't seen anything like that going on the site, but it is something, I guess I could keep an eye on. It's really, we're trying to keep it for people who've got too much stuff in their backyards, and also for small farmers to sort of let people in their area know, hey, we have stuff available.
Rob Anderson is one of the founders of VeggieTrader.com. I have the link at kcrw.com/goodfood. Gardening in an urban environment can be quite challenging. Not enough space is probably the biggest issue. Well, we've heard of someone who solved that problem in a unique way. I'll tell you next about mobile gardening, how a couple of guys turned the bed of a pickup truck into a productive growing space. That's next on Good Food. I'm your host, Devin Kleiman, and we'll be right back on KCRW. When I was a kid, I thought that a truck farm was a farm in a truck. Well, in Brooklyn, at least, it is. Ian Chaney and his partner, Kurt Ellis, are committed to raising awareness about sustainability issues in agriculture. Their company, Wicked Delicate, produced the documentaries King Corn and The Greening of Southie. But it's their farm in a pickup truck that has many of us thinking, what a good idea. Ian Chaney is with me this morning. What gave you the idea to create a farm in the bed of a pickup truck?
Well, we spent several years driving around this 1986 Dodge pickup truck in the process of making our film King Corn, which was really an exploration of the way in which subsidized, really overproduced corn is the raw material for some of our least healthful foods. And after finishing that film, we started asking ourselves really the follow-up question, which was, well, what do we do now, given that we have a system that makes junk food very available? How can we start designing alternative systems? At the same time, I was wondering what to do with this junky old pickup truck, whose miles per gallon were just headed down into the single digits. And having moved recently to New York and not owning any land in which I could grow my own food, it seemed like, if not quite the logical thing to do, it certainly seemed like the most fun thing to do was to try and actually grow food in the back of our pickup truck.
So in the process of doing this, did you have to do a lot of stuff to the truck first before you just started dumping dirt in?
Yeah, I mean, we spent several months kind of standing around the pickup truck scratching our heads, trying to imagine whether this would work. But actually, this little truck farm project follows on the heels of another film that Kurt and I made called The Greening of Southie, which is the story of Boston's first residential green building. But as part of that building, there was an enormous sloping planted roof on the top of it. And in some ways, the truck farm puts the King Corn project and the Greening of Southie project together by using green roof technology in the back of the truck.
So how so?
We contacted some folks who build these beautiful green roof structures all across the rooftops of Manhattan. And they supplied us with a couple things. The first was what was called a root barrier, which is just a 3 millimeter thick recycled plastic that sits on the bed of the truck and would, in theory, prevent the roots of whatever we managed to grow from kind of growing into the pickup truck itself. I think that's probably more important on an actual building roof than a pickup truck. But anyway, on top of that sits what's called a drainage mat, which almost looks like a bunch of egg cartons. And these little cups essentially hold water and make it available to the roots of the plants. And then there's holes drilled in every so often that allow excess water to drain out. So this is kind of the water management system. And then on top of that went about 8 inches of this funky, lightweight soil called Gaia soil, which is composed of a mix of recycled styrofoam, essentially, stuff that was just thrown out and then broken down and mixed with clay and organic compost. And so this serves as like the subsoil, you know, like the sand structure. So it allows water to go through, but it also holds a certain amount of water and holds a certain amount of nutrients for the roots of the plant. Then on top of that went burlap jute mat, and on top of that went a couple inches of organic compost, and then in went the seeds and a few prayers.
So are there certain types of plants that you had to lean towards, given that you didn't have, you know, 6 feet, 10 feet of root space?
Yeah, I think there were. I mean, some plants are doing better than others. I didn't think I could quite grow, carrots or potatoes in this soil. It didn't really seem possible. So we planted a mix of things. We planted some tomato plants and, 4 or 5 of them, and then a few broccoli plants, some basil right next to the tomatoes, and then 4 or 5 rows of arugula and heirloom lettuce seeds that we got from the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa. But as the summer has proceeded, we've actually had some neighbors actually add plants to the bed of the truck itself. So it's organic in that sense as well.
So in an ad hoc fashion, you would just come down one morning and see that something was growing there that wasn't there before?
Yeah. Mostly what's been appearing are these little plastic farm animal figures that neighbors have started depositing. And it's funny because they're all out of scale with each other. There's a bull, there's a tiny bull that's the size of a tiny goat, and then there's a snake, which is about 15 times larger than the bull and the snake, and there's a really huge cow. Also, folks seem to be moving them around at night so that there's a kind of a narrative going on, you know, the bull is trying to eat the snake, which is trying to ride the flamingo and so forth.
Now, what are you doing with the bounty?
There's two plans for the bounty. One is Kurt and I are simply eating it because maybe as almost test subjects, too, before we start feeding this to other people. That was really part of the project was a desire to eat more locally ourselves. But we also thought it would be good to recoup some of the costs of building the truck farm by using the community-supported agriculture CSA system. So we've been seeking subscribers in the farm. People pay. We've set a price of $20 ahead of time for a subscription for a share in what we think is probably New York City's tiniest CSA system.
So interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Ian Chaney is the founder, along with Kurt Ellis, of Wicked Delicate, a production company spreading awareness about sustainability and agriculture. They're documenting the pickup bed garden project with a time-lapse camera. See what it looks like by watching the Wicked Delicate videos at kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, a documentary about banana plantations, pesticides, and harmed workers turned out to be based on a fraudulent premise. Should the documentary be aired anyway? The claim, the controversy, and the true story. That's coming up on Good Food next on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
So what happens if the central premise of your documentary that's just about to be released turns out to be a fraud? That's what's happening with the new documentary called Bananas. Alexa Hyland from the Los Angeles Business Journal is here to share this very strange story. So first, let's share what the documentary is about. Who was the documentarian and what was his subject?
His name is Fredrik Gerten, and he is a Swedish filmmaker. And you know, he seems to do documentaries that focus a little bit more on people in third world countries and kind of how they are exploited by multinational corporations.
Okay, and this particular one focuses on the Dole banana business in Nicaragua, correct?
Correct, yes. And its central character is a Los Angeles attorney named Juan Dominguez, who is best known for his Accidentes ads that you'll see on the city's commuter buses.
So most of his business over the years has been personal injury.
Right. And just in the last probably 3-4 years, he's gotten involved specifically with these cases down in Nicaragua where men have, you know, claimed that they were made sterile by a pesticide used by Dole back in the 70s.
Now, Dole sort of has a track record of problems with litigation related to pesticide use, correct?
Yes, they do. I think there's about $2 billion worth of judgments pending in Nicaraguan courts right now over this issue. And then also there's been cases all over the states here in different courts with kind of the same basic allegation that Dole knowingly used this pesticide after the U.S. EPA determined that it was harmful to people.
So if Dole has this record of having problems with pesticides and has pending litigation all over the place, then what's the problem with the case that Juan Dominguez brought that was documented in Bananas, the
right.
documentary?
Well, the problem is that Juan Dominguez, along with a group of men in Nicaragua, including some lawyers there, basically created an enterprise and just recruited Nicaraguan men who were poor and promised them money in exchange for kind of enrolling in this program where they learned how to be banana workers, falsified lab reports to show that they were sterile, falsified work certificates to prove that they actually did work on these banana farms when they really didn't. And I think at the heart of it all, or what perhaps enabled this kind of fraudulent enterprise to go on, was that the Nicaraguan courts down there, they kind of allowed this to perpetuate, where everyone was just trying to go out and get people to get these multi-million dollar verdicts against the company.
Yeah, they sort of supported people getting their piece of Dole.
Exactly.
Wow. So have you finally seen the documentary?
I have to admit I did not. My editor actually saw the documentary, and you know, he said that it did portray Juan Dominguez as this larger-than-life character who would go down to Nicaragua and kind of hold these almost town hall rallies with these men to try to get them to become part of the enterprise.
Wow. I mean, it seems rather sad, because I'm sure some of those cases are probably real. And this kind of fraud just sort of...
It kind of taints it, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there's men out there who have, who have been harmed. And there are tons of cases everywhere. I believe in L.A. Superior Court alone, there's like 3,000 plaintiffs right now still pending from other countries beside Nicaragua. And it's just part of the judicial system on some level, and they've kind of gotten clogged up in there. So nothing has really moved us forward as these cases involving Juan Dominguez. These have been the only ones who really made it to the point of either reaching a trial or getting very close to a trial.
Wow. So in the end, you never really got an answer from Gerten as to whether or not
he had any idea while he was doing the film that some of Dominguez's work may have been fraud.
Yeah, I never got an answer.
Wow, so interesting.
Yeah, it really is.
Alexa Hyland wrote an article in the LA Business Journal about the banana documentary. I link to the full article at kcrw.com/goodfood. I created this project for myself this summer. It's called Pie a Day. Every day during the summer, I'm baking a pie. I'm a couple of weeks in so far. You can see my results on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Since this has become a popular feature, we started another project called Eat a Pie a Day. We're asking you to send a picture of a pie you're about to eat. We're posting those each day, too. Send a picture of the pie, of you eating the picture of the pie you wish you could eat, you get the idea. Send it to goodfood@kcrw.com and we'll post one each day on the blog. Nothing goes better with sweet pies than some ice cream. It happens to be one of my favorite foods. But where did ice cream come from? I'll tell you about the history of ice cream next. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on 89.9 KCRW. I love ice cream. I'm also a food history geek. So reading about the history of ice cream with a bowl of the stuff in my lap, well, that's just heaven. Jerry Quinzia's book is Of Sugar and Snow, A History of Ice Cream Making. I guess let's start first with the idea of icing drinks. How did people learn how to store ice or keep ice or make things cold?
Well, they loved ice and snow. I mean, they were both pretty hard to get and nearly impossible to store, so that made them great status symbols. But in the 16th century, Italian scientists began experimenting with freezing other substances, and they learned that you could freeze by adding salt to ice. So they tried to freeze wine. Well, wine won't freeze completely because it has alcohol in it. So they made a kind, what I think of as a kind of wine slushy, and that was a big hit on banquet tables of the era. And soon after that, cooks began experimenting with freezing the drinks they already made and the creams and custards that they already made. In fact, originally, in a lot of sources, they call them iced creams with a D, I-C-E-D, creams.
So who was the first one that's credited?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have one eureka moment and one name. One of the earliest people to write about it was Antonio Latini. He was in Naples, and that was in the 17th century. But he wrote something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but something to the effect that everyone in Naples is born knowing how to make ice cream. But they may have been born knowing how to make ice cream, but they weren't writing it down until actually in the 17th century.
So when did ice cream really come into its own as a sort of a beloved and familiar dessert, not something that was reserved for nobles or the rich?
Actually, that really wasn't until the 19th century when ice became more available. Up until then, it was widely known, and they made all sorts of ice creams in the 18th century, but they really were an elite treat. They really were for people who had means, not for the average person. And it wasn't until the 19th century that the average person was enjoying ice cream.
And then when it became sort of industrialized and became a business, who were the big players at the very beginning?
Well, the person who's credited with really making wholesale ice cream a business in America was Jacob Fussell. He was a Quaker, and he really saw the potential for making ice cream on a bigger scale than and distributing it on a bigger scale. But it took a long time before it became anything that was shipped to any distance. It was really a local business until pretty much the 20th century.
Because in early in the 20th century, it seems that ice cream is something that is it's seen as very communal. I mean, ice cream socials or the act of mm-hmm. churning ice cream during the summer and picnics and 4th of July, all of that seemed to go together.
Yes, and also street ice creams. At the beginning of the 20th century, the ice cream sandwich, the ice cream cone, what was called hokey pokies, which were sort of slices from a brick of ice cream that were sold on the street. That's when it became something that instead of just kings eating it, kids had a chance to eat it.
Do we Americans eat more ice cream than anybody else in the world?
Not quite. I understand that the people in New Zealand eat a little bit more than we do. We eat about 20 quarts per person a year. And that's been true for a very long time. We haven't kicked that up too much. But I believe that in New Zealand, they're up to 27 or something like that.
Wow, that's like almost 2 quarts a month.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a lot.
It's quite
a lot. I think it would be enough.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much. It's a really fascinating book, just really packed with information.
Thank you. I'm glad you like it.
Jerry Quinzio is a contributor to the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. She's written a book on ice cream called Of Sugar and Snow, A History of Ice Cream Making. So many cultures do a version of ice cream. There's Filipino ice cream, Persian ice cream. You can find a lot of these right here in L.A. There's a wonderful group that started treks through L.A. to find all the ethnic cuisines we're blessed to have here. Get your compass and your stomach ready. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Sometimes it's fun to have companions and even a guide when touring your own city. That's why LA Commons is such a great organization. Their mission is to build community by exploring our community. Their latest project is a tour of street food in Los Angeles. Karen Mack is the executive director of LA Commons.
In Los Angeles, we have a very complicated relationship with our street food. Despite the fact that we have so much of it, you know, generally, street food is sort of exists under the radar on many different levels, because we're in a car, because of the legislation that exists in the city, et cetera, et cetera. But yet, it thrives. You know, you find it in amazing corners throughout the city. Of course, there's a ubiquitous taco truck, which is so much a part of Los Angeles's storied culture.
Beyond the taco truck, though, what do we have here that's street food?
Well, tamales, of course. Tamales are the global street food, I think, particularly in Latin America, which, of course, so much defines Los Angeles. Mama's Hot Tamales is one of our major partners. And what's amazing about Mama's Hot Tamales is that you can go there and get tamales from, you know, on any given day from many different countries throughout Latin America.
Is there street food in L.A. that goes beyond the Latino?
Oh, of course. In our tour series, and let me just talk a little bit about that, because we are calling it this year, and this is the third year for Trekking Los Angeles, Local Adventures in a Global City, and this year it's Global Feast on Local Streets. So we have been going, in our partnership with UCLA, to Highland Park, Leimert Park, East Hollywood for the last couple years, and of course East Hollywood has Thai Town and Little Armenia. And this year we're adding MacArthur Park to the rotation. And so Leimert Park, for example, the heart of the city's African American community, of course you can find street food there. And the one that comes to mind most immediately is Jamaican Patties, which the restaurant Aki Bamboo, which if you like Jamaican food, you have got to go to this restaurant because it is some of the best, I would argue the best Jamaican food in Los Angeles. But of course, they have Jamaican Patties, which, for those of you who are familiar with Latin cuisine, is on the order of an empanada, but larger, and filled with your choice of beef, chicken, and they are made vegetarian as well, and flavored with those very unique Jamaican spices. And they are wonderful examples of street food.
Typically, how many people come along on these excursions?
Well, we try and keep it fairly intimate because our goal as an organization is to take people on explorations, but really to connect people to the city. And we feel like it's the people in the city that are really what are the attractions. And so we want people to be able to have a fairly intimate experience, both with locals as well as people on the tour, their comrades on the tour. So 25 is really the outer limit of the number of people that we can have on the tour.
Do you think that right now, in terms of what's happening with the economy, and particularly with small family-owned and individually-owned businesses, that this is particularly important?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's important for us in general. I mean, I think what we like to think of is this provides people with an opportunity to have a vacation in their own city, which, you know, I mean, the city, I love my job because I get to go around to all these amazing places and connect to people, you know, who I wouldn't come into contact ordinarily, and that opportunity is available to everyone.
Karen Mack is the executive director of LA Commons. Their Trekking LA series goes next to make tamales and eat Jamaican patties. Details are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Our favorite culinary trekker and guide is Jonathan Gold. He's won a Pulitzer Prize for the writing about LA's huge ethnic eats, and we're happy to get a peek into his notebook each week to see what he's been eating. He's next on Good Food. That's in 1 minute right here on KCRW and KCRW.com. We're lucky to have Jonathan Gold be a part of Good Food nearly every week. Jonathan Gold, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize winning writer for the LA Weekly. He joins us quite often to share a new place to try. Where are we going today?
Roland Heights. One of my favorite restaurants, or my favorite Shanghai-style restaurant in the San Gabriel Valley, was always Green Village. And Green Village moves so much that it's almost like watching a ping pong match. You know, it's like Temple City to Roland Heights to San Gabriel to Roland Heights to San Gabriel again to Roland Heights to a third time in San Gabriel. And for a few months last year, they were actually in none of them when the one in Roland Heights caught fire.
But now it's back. In Roland Heights.
In Roland Heights.
Green Village.
Green Village. It's in the Diamond Plaza, which is this thing that you're driving down the street and you don't even see it. There are Pacific islands that are smaller than this place. There are like cities in China that are smaller than this. It's an enormous mall.
And what is Shanghai cuisine?
Shanghai cuisine, or the cuisine of East China, tends to rely a lot on seafood. They're big on pork. The sauces are more complex than they tend to be down south, but they're also heavier, you know, sweeter. There's a lot more rock sugar involved. There's a lot more braising of things than there tends to be. It's not spicy. They eschew spiciness, but Sichuan food is as popular in Shanghai as Mexican food is here, so there's a lot of crossover. And there also tends to be a lot of vegetarian stuff because it's a big center of Buddhist monks.
So where does that leave us with dining at Green Village? What should we look for?
Green Village used to be famous, or to me famous, for this an almost impenetrable menu. There are some dishes that I would literally look for half an hour when I got in. I could not find them on the menu, and you try to explain what you want. Now, almost everything you'd want is actually like on a little like table stand-up card.
Like the specials.
You can go through the menu, and there's a lot of stuff that's not on there that's really good, but you can just, you know, choose from the dozen or 15 dishes on the stand-up card, and you're great. Some of the great appetizers are, they do one of the best versions of wine chicken I've ever had, which is poached chicken, which is then marinated in this sort of strong potion of Chinese wine that soaks into it and infuses every tiny bit, every molecule, and it's just wonderful. It's slightly sweet, it's slightly alcoholic, it has that little tinge of bitterness to it. There's a wonderful dish of tofu minced with wild greens, which are listed on the wild greens are listed on the menu by their Latin name, which I don't remember. Nobody at the restaurant will know, but it saves you from having to sort of mime what kind of green it is that you want, which I always did before. That was always one of the dishes I could never find. The dish of theirs that's probably the most copied is of fried croaker with seaweed. The fish is cut into fingers and it's dipped into, I guess, sort of a tempura-like batter, flecked with seaweed, and then it's deep fried. They're amazing at frying because it comes out super light and super fluffy, almost like a cruller that happens to have fish inside. And you dip it in spicy salt or not as you want. And it's sort of the French fry effect of having like really great French fries.
Wow, that sounds fabulous.
It's a good dish. You should probably look into the duck soup, which seems expensive at $25. But it's an enormous dish. If there's not a whole duck in there, there's at least a half duck in there. And the broth is concentrated in flavor to the extent that it just oozes duckiness. Usually when you get a duck soup in Chinese restaurants, it's either flavored with extraneous things or it's super milky and super bony, which you know is probably healthy for you but doesn't have much flavor to it. This one, a spoonful of broth, you feel as if you're biting into the duck. There's that much presence in it.
Wow. That sounds wonderful.
It's a good dish. Probably you might want to look into getting a braised crab with rice cake. It's a crab that's cooked with all the good Shanghai stuff, you know, all the garlic, all the rock sugar, all the
yum
aromatics, and served on top of a bed of, sometimes they translate it as ovalettes, but they're sort of these oval thin rice cakes, like super thick noodles that absorb every drop of the crab essence and become actually more compelling than the crab itself, which is pretty damn compelling.
That sounds amazing. So once again, what is this lovely Shanghai restaurant called?
This is Green Village.
And it is?
1390 Fullerton Road in Roland Heights in the Diamond Plaza.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
Directions to Green Village can be found at kcrw.com/goodfood, along with a map of all of the restaurants Jonathan has mentioned on the show over the years. If you've got a suggestion or a comment, please leave it on our site. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Have you ever had Venezuelan cuisine? I hadn't until my next guest came in with an incredible sampling of this interesting cuisine. A Taste of South America. That's coming up on Good Food. I'm your host, Devin Kleiman, and you're listening to 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. One thing I absolutely love about global politics is that as soon as a country's in the limelight, it becomes a reminder to enlarge your palate and learn how others eat. So no matter what you think of Hugo Chavez, the food of Venezuela is completely delicious. Camilla Cupal is one of the owners of Cupa Cafe in Beverly Hills. And I'm sitting, I have to say, Camilla, you went insane. I'm sitting in front of boxes and boxes and boxes of really incredible treats. So talk to me a little bit about the cuisine of Venezuela.
So Venezuela, I mean, it's not really known for its cuisine as much as, like, you know, Peru, Peruvian cuisine or Mexican cuisine is so much more elaborate. Venezuela's a lot of staple foods. So you've got shredded beef, a lot of cheese, corn, arepas, which are like bread for, what, you know, in other countries. But it's very basic foods that they make in their own traditional type of way. And I brought a little bit of all the traditional things here.
Yes, you did. Everything. You didn't leave anything out. Now, when you talk about cheese, what kind of cheese is it usually?
It's mostly fresh white cheeses. They're very, very fresh. Nothing's aged. And they're usually not pasteurized. But
and they're cow's milk cheeses primarily?
Yes, cow milk.
So I'm now looking at a dish that looks like a tiny little pancake.
It's a fresh corn pancake, exactly. It's fresh corn off the cob that's basically grated into a pancake. And that cheese on top of it is called queso de mano, like hand cheese.
Hand cheese, I love that.
It's very good cheese. It's delicious. It goes great with a cachapa. And here you have the nata. Nata is Venezuelan-style sour cream. It's a little sweet, but it goes great with a combination.
So cachapa is this corn pancake.
Correct.
Now, these, the first thing I tasted actually before we came on the air, are they look like zucchini fingers, but better.
They're called tequeños. T-E-Q-U-E-N-O-S. They're served at every party in Venezuela, every wedding, social event. They're served hot. It's a white flour dough that's wrapped around Venezuelan cheese called queso paisa. And it's served with a homemade guava dipping sauce. Queso paisa is a little harder, a little saltier.
And this is sort of like a mozzarella stick.
Sort of, Venezuelan style.
But so much better, I have to say. Yeah, and that combination of white cheese and guava is very delicious. Yeah, yum. What is this little bite here? It's got a little toothpick.
These
stuck
are called maracuchitos. Maracaibo is a state in Venezuela where these are very popular, and it's a sweet fried plantain that's sliced thin, and it's wrapped around a cheese called queso duro. Like a hard cheese, salty, very salty, but the plantain is sweet, so it's also another great combination. The other staple dish in Venezuela are arepas. Arepas are served for breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, all day long. There's areperas, so arepa stands all over the country. They're usually open 24 hours. Basically, it's a corn griddle cake. We bake it, take out the dough, and then stuff it. You can stuff it with cheese, eggs, chicken, beef, any choices. In the restaurant, we have a lot of choices.
It's stuffed after the griddle cake is cooked.
It's cooked, correct.
Arepas are interesting because, you know, whenever you talk to New Yorkers and you talk about ethnic food, I feel like a lot of times areperas are sort of like the New York equivalent to our taco truck in a way.
In a way.
But a lot of Los Angelinos don't have very much exposure to arepas.
There's very few Venezuelans in L.A., but, you know, they're starting to get it, the hang of arepas here.
So we've been talking about all savory foods. Are there more savory foods?
Yes.
What are in these?
Well, inside those arepas, it's the reina pepiada.
Now, what is reina pepiada?
Reina pepiada is, I'd say, the most traditional arepa in Venezuela. It's a chicken salad with avocado and mayonnaise, basically. The reason, you know, I also chose this one is because it's cold. So the arepa, if you put something hot in it, it starts to get soggy if you don't eat it right away.
And is this an empanada?
It's the cazón empanada, which is a young shark empanada.
Is that a very common dish?
Very traditional. In Margarita, an island off of Venezuela, this is the most popular empanada. So it's a small shark. It's very hard to find here in California, but they find it for me. And we shred it a lot and then cook it with garlic and soy sauce and sweet peppers and then stuff it inside the empanada.
See a video of Camilla Cupal and the Venezuelan food she brought to the studio. It's online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Camilla's the owner of Cupa Cafe on Cannon Drive in Beverly Hills. The image of mom handing kids milk and cookies after a day at school is pure nostalgia. We love our cookies in this country. Some cookies with some really interesting names have disappeared along with their recipes. Two sisters from Boston are plucking these obscure cookies from the past. Numshadoles, anyone? Heirloom cookies when Goodfood returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. It is time once again for the fabulous Brass Sisters. We're going to talk with them about some heirloom cookies that they've discovered, some with funny names, some with interesting origins, but all seemingly taking them to a place of cookie heaven. So ladies, describe the cookie heaven for me.
Well, this is Marilyn, just so you'll know who you're talking to. And I want you to know that Heirloom Cookie Heaven is a very special place. We've taken you to heaven before, but this is sort of a very exclusive neighborhood. It's like the gated community of heaven. And it's a wonderful place to live because no one ever gains weight. And there are no calories in the cookies. And Sheila will tell you something about the cookie jars.
Yes, we want you to get your hand caught in the cookie jar, or have you get caught in the cookie jar.
I mean, you can crawl into the cookie jar for all we care, because we want to keep it loaded with wonderful cookies. And the cookie jars are always full in Heirloom Cookie Heaven.
Let's talk about the kind of cookies that are in that jar in Heirloom Cookie Heaven. When people think about funny cookie names, they go first to the snickerdoodle.
And they're cinnamon and sugar-topped cookies, and they mean little snail.
Oh!
And they go all the way back to, the Dutch colonies in the United States. And they're very easy to make. They're a drop cookie.
And delicious.
And delicious. Really delicious.
That's the bottom line.
Oh, it has to be the bottom line.
Yes. And also, I just want to remind everyone that these recipes that we're using for cookies and bars are all from handwritten recipes.
Tried and true.
Yes.
Now, I have a name here that I don't even know if I'm going to be able to pronounce. Numshadoles?
I think you did a great job, Evan, because it took me a while, too. And we found this, actually. This is a little bit different. We found this recipe, which I will describe, as an old family recipe from the Austin family. It's fried dough that you make like biscuits, then you drop into boiling molasses.
Oh, my God.
And then you can serve it for breakfast. And they said the original recipe calls for most of the fat to be either bear grease, deer tallow, or both. Sounds yummy.
So what did you do?
I'm not sure it fits the definition of cookie for us.
Well, the question is, where are we going to get bear grease?
Right.
Well, there are a few wild bears around, but not in my neighborhood.
Now, I love the cookie with the name Better Than Robert Redford.
I don't believe that anything is better than Robert Redford.
But maybe it's more easily available.
Well, yes. Definitely that.
Better Than Robert Redford is a layered cookie that's a bar. And it used, that refrigerated whipped topping. It was one of those quickies that you use lemon pudding.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to contradict ourselves a little bit. We said all the recipes were from handwritten recipes. We actually found a treasure, and the treasure is a binder full of typed and reproduced, copied recipes from an insurance company employee association, and all the women contributed recipes to that. And it was never printed. It was just something that was given out within the company. So we found Better Than Robert Redford, and we found the Numshadoles in that one. So it's just, it's really learning a lot about culinary history when you look at these recipes.
And also who was from the claims department.
Yes.
You never know when you need someone from there.
Hey, absolutely. What are meltaways?
Meltaways are like melting moments. They're very heavy on the butter.
And they melt in your mouth.
And they're really good. And they, too, are drop cookies. And the melting moments are more of an English and a Canadian cookie. And these meltaways are sort of an American cousin.
Now, are these the ones that you roll in powdered sugar?
I think powdered sugar, as we refer to it, confectioner's sugar, does have a very strong role in these cookies.
Yes. And now they're put on when they're warm, mm-hmm, out of the oven.
Yeah.
And it almost forms a special secret glaze.
Like a self-glaze. But the part I like is that you can sift more sugar on them after they cool.
Oh, definitely. There's no such thing as
too much
sugar.
You know, and we don't believe in wretched excess. You know, we just...
Excess can never be wretched, right?
No.
That's right.
No. The Alcoholic Beverages Council doesn't have to worry about us. We actually use their product, not in quite the way they, you know, think we might.
One of our friends gave us a recipe for a wine cookie, and we have wine at home. So the first thing I used was Merlot, because I had a bottle of that. And the cookies didn't taste like wine at all, but the color was beautiful.
Beautiful.
Pale pink, almost violet.
Then we tried, was it Chardonnay?
Yes.
And the wine cookies don't really taste a lot like wine, but they have a very fruity flavor. And they're not the typical wine cookies that are like dipping cookies. You can dip these, but they're not that hard, traditional wine cookie.
Well, I called my friend back and said, what am I going to do? They don't taste like wine. And she said, they don't have to. You can dip them. You can nibble them.
But they're a very nice cookie.
I can't wait to see this book. Thank you so much, Brass Sisters.
Our pleasure.
The Brass Sisters are currently working on a book about heirloom cookies that they say, remarkably, have no calories. At least the pages don't. I can't vouch for the actual cookies. If you've got some good memories of cookies you don't see anymore, post it on our site in the comments section. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. You can connect with me and other Good Food listeners by becoming a fan of me on Facebook. We do cookbook giveaways and we share food pictures and stories. Follow me on Twitter too. I'm at Evan Kleiman, only one N in the last name. You can download the show and podcast it too. Find the Good Food video app and find all the info we talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. Harriet Ells produced and edited this program, along with Holly Tarson, Bob Carlson, Jillian Ferguson, Connie Alvarez, and Candace Moyer. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.